Red Film Radio.
Red Film Radio.
Interview.
Interview.
Fred Film Radio, this is Chiara Nicoletti. I'm in virtual company of John Madden, director of Operation Mincemeat, L'Arma dell'Inganno, Operazione Mincemeat. The film had its world premiere in Malaga, Spain, and its Italian one at the Bari Film Festival, and it will be released in cinemas from May 12th, thanks to Warner Brothers. This is a very surreal story, but it's all real, and it's based on historical facts. And at the same time, it is also kind of an origin story of one of the most beloved characters of literature and cinema, James Bond, a.k.a. 007. How important was for you to also portray this aspect?
It was a gift, I suppose, in a way, from a cinematic point of view, because sitting in the middle of the story was Ian Fleming, now a name everybody knows. He hadn't started writing at that point in his life, or at least he was writing bizarre ideas about how to fool the enemy in this tome called the Trout Memo, which we talk about in the film. And, you know, he was one of many writers, almost all the people who comprised the 20 Committee, which is the sort of beating heart of wartime intelligence, were writers. And it was one of the extremely interesting facts about this very interesting story that they lived half in a sort of fictional world, a world of speculation, a world of unexpected twists and turns and upendings. And this idea that the this disinformation strategy really grew out of that. I mean, we kind of harness, because it's true, the idea of, you know, Fleming sitting in the midst of this and watching an extraordinary story unfold, whose ending, of course, he doesn't know. And in a sense, that's true of the audience, perhaps not the Italian audience so much, because it's probably an event that people remember. It's the point at which the Allies gained a foothold on Europe again. But elsewhere in the world, it's not a well-known story. It would have been if it had ended differently. So it's quite interesting to make a film of this, because the outcome probably is still uncertain for the audience, just as it was for the characters in it. There are ways in which the film keeps reflecting itself in the storytelling, which makes it an interesting piece to work with.
It's amazing to see strong women at the center of a male-dominated setting. So what do you think of this aspect of the film?
Well, I'm delighted that, you know, somebody's responding in that way. I mean, it was very important to us. And, you know, they function, both of the female characters, really as the kind of emotional heart and the conscience, I suppose, of the story. As the men inevitably fall into a kind of competitive sense of who wants to control the narrative and so on, because they were very, very different characters, Montague and Cholmondeley. The women are the ones who find the same path through that. it's just, women are the center of the universe, I'm afraid, in my world. So I always gravitate towards the woman's perspective in everything I do, even if the men are technically in the front line. Yes, well, not in charge, but yes, certainly. So it was a very, Michelle is a, you know, very, very intelligent writer with a unique but not ghettoized perspective, you know, and really wanted to integrate all of that into the story. And we were completely in agreement about that.
I was working with Colin Firth again 20 years after Shakespeare in Love.
Well, it's not for want of trying, is all I can say. Not that he turned me down. We've been circling each other with different projects for quite a while. He's a very, very close neighbor of mine. And so I threw the odd script over his fence more than once and got a couple back. It just, the timing didn't work out. And but this time it did. He seems a glove fit for this part to me. You know, he's a very, very, very bright man, Colin, and so was Montague. You know, he was a very, very formidable King's Counsel. So, you know, a barrister, very quick-witted, very urbane, determined to leave all of that behind and do his, you know, make his effort for the war. Colin's a very engaged person politically, very, you know, the issues of dissent are very much at his heart, I think. And so we batted a lot of discussion around about what we didn't want this film to be. We didn't want it to be an argument for Brexit. Thank you very much. Yeah, we've wanted to work together for a long time, you know, since we hooked up. And Shakespeare in Love was not the first one. We tried to work together on another project before that, but that didn't happen for some reason.
Was it harder to build the suspense in the film, considering that people already know the story?
I think the, you know, the simple thing, these are people who think they know a great deal about the world. You know, they've got probably a more than common intelligence and analytical skills, and they feel they know the right way of doing things, or they're feeling their way towards the right way of doing things. And the story of the film, in terms of what's happening to those characters, is that all that certainty leaches out of them, drains away, because they suddenly find that there is no certainty. There's no guarantee of anything. You know, Montague says at one line, when they wonder whether or not it may be that von Renner is the key figure in the situation, and that just possibly he's whispering certainties into Hitler's ears, which are, of course, falsehoods. He says a line, he says, that's either true or it's a fiction that we want to be true. And I think the torment and the kind of horror that fills their souls by the end is the idea that they might have actually created the exact opposite effect. And there's no way they can know. They can't know whether they're being gamed by the enemy in terms of, you know, a massive piece of counter deception, which was the world they lived in. But when it sits squarely on their shoulders, that becomes a very, very heavy burden to carry. And interestingly, Ian Fleming, to go back to the first point of departure of this discussion, is sitting in the midst of it. They're just attracted by the idea of the story itself, but at the same time having to stop at the moment where they're literally on the brink of discovering whether it's going to end tragically or triumphantly. That's a true storyteller. He takes a puff on his cigarette and stops and looks around the room, but at the same time, of course, is pulled into it.
Did you realize that you actually put together two Mr. Darcy's? How did you choose the actors, the cast?
Darcy was not uppermost in my mind. Let me put it that way. Okay. It occurred to us once the casting solidified. Well, I mean, actually, in truth, Matthew was a late arrival because he looked as if he wasn't available because he was doing another season of Succession. But actually, the writing got delayed on that and pushed back. And suddenly that avenue opened up because it felt like the absolutely perfect casting. And only after we'd signed it all did it occur to us that we have two Darcys in the middle of this film, almost of separate generations. You know, that's more of a marketing interest, I suppose, than interest to me. But, you know, in a sense, I'm always interested in those situations where you talk about two people who are very different. But I certainly wondered during the course of making the film what would happen if I switched them around, inverted the casting, because there are qualities in both of them that would have produced different and interesting effects, I think. I kind of would like the movie to define itself without my having to put a bunch of labels on it. But I certainly, I'm very attracted to films that have a mixed tone. You know, the Shakespeare in Love obviously is sits there as a sort of a thing in my career. And that's a pretty classic example. But honestly, that's a Shakespearean, mature Shakespearean comedy is exactly that. It's a something that veers between comedy, farce, emotion, romance, and usually death, or usually darkness in some form. So I think weaving and braiding those things together, or navigating your way through them, is a challenge I particularly enjoy. So I don't know that I want to put a label on it, to be honest with you.
If you were to shut the film right now, would you do something different considering the time we're living? And would you try to highlight something in particular?
That's a very good question. And I'm not sure that I know how to answer it, except to say that, you know, I think it's always a great danger when you want to try and generalize about something. The way to find the truth of a story, I think, is to immerse yourself in the particularities of it and the specificities of it. I mean, it might have given us pause, obviously, had we been thinking about making the film now, because we would have been overshadowed by what's going on, because the Russia-Ukraine conflict trumps everything else right now. It's too horrifying. It's too frightening. It's too standing on the edge of a precipice, which may start to engulf us all, because obviously even in 1943, we were only on the brink of discovering how the magnitude and power of the weaponry that was being developed. So, one might have had pause, I think. As it is, we made the film as close to the realities that the film was about as we could. And that would be my instinct in this situation as well. And then it's for people watching it to feel different resonances, I suppose. But I just have to repeat my disclaimer. I really don't want to be trying to persuade anybody of the relevance of this film to current situations, because it's the wrong way around. And I don't want that to be in anybody's mind. I don't want anybody to be thinking, you must go and see this film because... Grazie.
And I would like to thank director John Madden for Operation Mincemeat, L'Arma dell'Inganno, Operazione Mincemeat, screening in cinema from May 12th with Warner Brothers, and this is Chiara Nicoletti for Fred, the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on fred.fm and smartphone apps.